of course, all the difficulties between Ireland and England weren't merely religious. The religious differences just served to accentuate the problems, the political problems, the land problems, all of that. And so in the centuries of Reformation and post-Reformation, there was quite a lot of warfare and bloodshed throughout the country. This tended to polarise between Native Irish and planters or settlers from England and Scotland, to polarise between Irish Catholic and the new Protestant churches. And so, right down through the centuries since, the damage that this has done, and the fact that problems, political problems, social problems, religious problems, all of them were defined by religion and by religious affiliation, has made lots of problems, made lots of problems for evangelism, made lots of problems for anyone who steps outside the run of things, anyone who does anything different, and certainly for anyone who stands up to preach the gospel in public or to press out. This made problems right down through the centuries. It made it easy to, for those who opposed to the gospel, it made it easy to stigmatize it as being foreign religion. Even when those who were doing the opposing themselves were affiliated to a most foreign of religions, which still had a foreign language and owed its allegiance to a city on the Tiber, to the papacy, to Rome. But it was easy to make that. And on the other hand, it was all too easy for even Bible-believing Christians to fall back into their bigger shelter of Protestantism and to a British allegiance, a British political and social allegiance, and to look upon the Native Irish as more or less unconvertible and to be outside the pale, outside the possibility of grace. And that, as we see, affected things right on down and up to, I would say, even the present day in some circumstances. Well, we'll see that a little bit more about that in a moment. Whereas the Reformation, as is generally known worldwide, and certainly Europe and US wide, whereas that Reformation had little or no impact upon Native Irish, and certainly upon Gaelic speaking Ireland, there did come a period when there was real Reformation, and we might say revival or impact of the gospel upon a wide cross-section of the Irish and Irish-speaking, Gaelic-speaking people. In the mid-1700s, in England, rose up John Wesley, preaching the gospel, himself excluded from the Church of England, which was his family church and where he grew up, because of his tendency to go outside and to preach the gospel at every opportunity and in public and on the streets and all of that, and which gave rise ultimately to the formation of the new Methodist connection, which eventually became the Methodist Church. Happily, Wesley himself took an interest in Ireland, and over the course of 40 years, he made 20, I think it's 21 or 22 visits here, which, considering, you know, that it was boat and horse, was quite an undertaking and quite an input into Ireland. Obviously, as an English-speaking man, an English man, he was largely confined to the English-speaking population. In other words, Dublin, the bigger cities, and to the Protestant population. But he saw the need and he saw the possibilities. And he encouraged amongst his converts, amongst those who had Gaelic as well as English, he encouraged them to use it in promoting the gospel. Encouraged it to the extent that it became very common to find Gaelic-speaking evangelists travelling the country from one end to the other, working flat out. And indeed, arising from that, a huge number of the Irish population came to Christ, found life, found reality, for the first time since way back in that earlier period that we spoke of, when the gospel was quite common through the monastic churches and monastic church activity back in the medieval period. So, what happened with Wesley? Well, the wonder of it was, first, that it was a move of God, that the Holy Spirit's blessing was upon it, that the life of the Holy Spirit was on the work of the gospel there. Secondly, that Wesley and those around him, themselves being outcast from the established church, didn't feel any need to be careful about where they went, and didn't owe any super allegiance to a form of faith or a form of religion or a form of church that was alien in the Irish situation. And the second wonder of it was that even those who would never have been known as Methodists, certainly within Anglicanism, within the Church of Ireland, and to some degree within Presbyterianism as well, but certainly within the Church of Ireland, that many were affected by the spirit of Wesley, by the gospel of Wesley, by this thing that was happening before their eyes. And many, if you like, caught the bug and themselves became very active preachers of the gospel. Again, it's probably easier to give an example or two than to try to describe a wide sweeping movement. Not many people remember now that right down the west coast of Ireland, there was quite a line of, right from Donegal to Kerry, there was quite a line of evangelical churches came into existence. Whether we look in Donegal, whether we look in Dingle down in the very southwest, the impact of the gospel, Irish speaking, Irish practicing, churches. Some of them Methodist, some of them Anglican, or Church of Ireland, as we call it here. Episcopalian, if you like. But all of them having this about them, that they preached the gospel and worshipped in the Irish language, or through the Irish language. That was a huge change. And the discovery of it was, of course, as I mentioned already, that the Irish people were more than ready to hear good news, or quite a lot of them were, to hear good news. So that this was much more a Bible or gospel reformation than that which had happened 2 centuries before. Much more so. As I say, by way of example, in Mayo, Achill Island, in the early 1800s, was very different from what it is today. First of all, access to it it really was an island. Today it has road linkage, but back then it was by boat and very difficult. And certainly difficult and dangerous, in especially in stormy weather, there on the Atlantic. As well as that, its population was very dense, very high population of people there. From time to time, efforts had been made by this religious society or that to go and evangelize amongst the people of Achill. But without any success. And they usually folded their tents and left fairly quickly. In 1828, interestingly, just the same time as an English Baptist society, were packing up because they couldn't make any headway amongst these thick peasants, you know, who couldn't even speak English. A man arrived there, a man called Edward Nangle. He was a minister of the Church of Ireland, himself a devout Christian. But he was there because he was taking a break, because his health had broken and he wasn't good. And he went there for a visit, and he saw, and it would appear that God spoke to him and touched him about not just the possibility, but the crying need for the preaching of the gospel on Achill Island. He returned home and needed to spend the next year recuperating from his illness. But he made it his business during that year to become fluent in Irish, of which he did not have a word prior to that. He returned in 1829 and began preaching there. There were those who came to help him, and he welcomed them. But he made it a rule that if after 6 months they couldn't preach a sermon and conduct a full service through the medium of Gaelic, then it was obvious that God hadn't called them there and they would go home. But as a result of this preaching and this reaching out, in an island where there was no church of any kind, no church building of any kind, Nangle had to build on this small island 3 church buildings to facilitate the number of people coming under the sound of the gospel. And while not all of us would be very much given to confirmations and things like that, and such sacraments, but it is a sign that we know the numbers, that after 2 years there, there were several hundred presenting for confirmation at the hands of the Church of Ireland bishop when he visited. No, that won't necessarily get you into heaven, but it's an indicator of the impact of the preaching of the gospel, that this many people were coming on their sound and coming to listen and coming to respond to what Nangle was preaching. That spread out onto the mainland of County Mayo and the area round about. It gave rise to quite a reaction from the Roman Catholic bishops and clergy, and especially when he started schools on the island, and they moved to deal with it. So they themselves began to do what they'd never done before for generations, was to send clergy actually to Achill Island. There was enough happening to disturb the powers that be. That was just one place. I mean, obviously, the story of Achill Island goes on quite a bit. But that was just one place. As I say, right down that coastal area, the whole way, the whole length of Ireland, in the, not just Gaelic speaking, but where absolutely Gaelic speaking, where there was no English at all, no English language spoken, other than in the city of Galway, people responded in huge numbers. And this was through a gospel, if you like, of a Wesleyan hue, a Methodist hue, and I mean Methodist of its time, where the emphasis was on conversion to Christ, the infilling of Christ, the replacement theology, if you like, of it. In other words, of the replacement of the old life with the Christ life. It was that kind of gospel. Mm-hmm. And we really should remember that mm-hmm. that this was a very, if you like, a very full gospel. I don't know what a half full gospel is, but this was a very full gospel. Mm-hmm. And impacted on their lives. Now, during this period, there were frequent times of hunger in Ireland. I mean physical hunger, of famine. But on partial scales, in one area or another, or maybe for one season. Of course, in peasant Ireland, the potato was the staple diet. Eaten three times a day in every home. It was... staple diet. Other crops grown went to pay the rent to usually absentee landlords in England or whatever. And it was something that the Irish people lived with, and it was a very grievous thing, but they lived with it and waited for next year when the crop would return. But come the middle of the 1840s, and the experience in Ireland was a famine that they had never known before. Because for three full years, the potato crop failed universally throughout the country for 3 years in succession. That is like if rice stopped growing in China. That's like... that's the kind of scale that it was on. In other words, the food of the vast majority of the population was just gone. There were many efforts made to, you know, with soup kitchens and whatever, but in the face of total famine, total crop failure, not just for 1 year, not for 2 years, but for 3 years. In the face of that, the starvation, the disease and death that came from it, this changed everything. Socially changed everything in Ireland. from a population of about 9 million in 1940, due to the famine and its after effects, both of death and of emigration, by the 1860s, that number had almost halved and continued right down through emigration right down to the 1970s before the Irish population began to increase again. That was the impact. That was so huge, both of physical hunger, of the totality of it. It affected the psyche of the Irish people. And it explains something that people have often questioned. If the second Reformation that I've been describing, if this revival and if this gospeling of the 1750 to the middle of the 19th century was so powerful, where did it go to? Where are the churches? Where are they throughout the south of Ireland? Where are they all? Well, it's rather simple. Of course, many died. There's no doubt about that. But vast numbers of the new converts, or the couple of generation converts are somewhere, but many of them just quite new converts, like an Ackle, had gone to America or to Newfoundland, and such like places, in the most horrific of conditions, on the coffin ships they were referred to as, because the numbers were so huge. The numbers who died on board, the numbers who died in transit, were huge. But huge numbers of them made their way, particularly to the United States. And it was these who were the backbone of the growing success, if you like, though it's not a great word to use in spiritual terms, but of the great growth of Methodism throughout the United States. And it's why many Methodist churches in the U.S. can trace their roots back to the Irish immigration of the mid 19th century. So yes, Ireland lost hugely through that dreadful time. But like it says about Jerusalem in those early days, those who were scattered abroad went everywhere gossiping the gospel. Mm-hmm. That was part of the impact. That was part of the, that's part of what God can do, even with the tragedy and even with a disaster on the scale that this was. But to the country left behind, again, those tremendous bitterness. It was easy to blame the English and the English government, who were rather slow in bringing any relief. Any relief that came through religious groups, missionaries, churches, the Quakers, and such like groupings. But in the after years, even this added to the bitterness in Ireland and gave rise to such words as supers and jumpers. Now, they're English words. They sound like English words, but they are pure Irish, I can tell you. A super was a nickname applied to somebody who went and used the soup kitchens that were run maybe by evangelical Christians. Jumpers was the name given to those who actually left the Catholic Church and joined such evangelical churches. And of course, for those who wanted to, or who still want to, cause bitterness over this whole period and this whole issue, it was very easy to make the argument. People were going to soup kitchens, people were hearing the gospel, people were responding to the gospel, people were changing churches, so they were being bought. It was an easy argument to make. Facile, we know, but very easy to make and very easy to believe, and has become part of the unhappy folklore of Irish history. And yet today, as we look on a world that's hungry in many, many parts, and still our great states largely leave it up to unprepared missionaries and church groups and rock bands to raise the money to feed the starving. Things don't really change that much in 150 years. But as I say, it has added or been used to add to the bitterness between Catholics and Protestants in Ireland. And particularly to the bitterness between Catholic authorities and active evangelical Christians. That has been quite a bit of the problem. And remember what I said about all the questions, both political and social and religious, all being wrapped up together in the one. And the question of national allegiance, all nicely divided into two packages. So you have Irish Catholic people, and those two words tend to mean the same thing, or you have British, English, if you like, Protestants, and that divide has been made. And this is something at such a deep level in the psyche of the Irish psyche that outsiders get it hard to understand. And even those of us who have grown up here and lived their lives here often get it hard to understand the depth of it. To understand the extent that it is to blame for what we euphemistically call the recent 30 years of troubles, and slaughter and terrorism and reprisals and all of that that's gone on in the north of Ireland up until recently. Following that period, and right into the 20th century, and right up through quite a bit of the 20th century, evangelical Christians in the south of Ireland. In the north of Ireland, the evangelical church, and certainly general Protestantism, was very strong. But even evangelical churches were very strong in the north of Ireland. And it was it's just part of the culture, part of what they are. Almost two-thirds of the population of Northern Ireland would have been traditionally Protestant, but as I say, very many of them evangelical. in the South, in the Republic of Ireland, especially after independence in 1922, and I hate the expression, but it's the best one I can use at the moment, the non-Catholic population fell down to about 5%, because rightly or wrongly, Protestants didn't feel welcome in the new state and left to go to Northern Ireland, or those who were really English or akin to England moved to England or Scotland. So that the new state, the Irish Free State as it was at first, then the Irish Republic, became really very much a Roman Catholic state. And that's just a fact, written into our constitution, until it was removed recently by the vote of the people. But up until, the first 50 years of the state, it was written in the special position of the Catholic Church as the faith of the majority of Irish citizens, etc., etc. And that had huge impact on law, on all kinds of things. That has changed, let me say, but it was there and still lives in the minds of people. One of the sad impacts of all this was that those who had something of the gospel in the evangelical churches in the north, while they were happy to send their children out as missionaries to Japan, to Africa, to the headhunters in Borneo, to the jungles of South America, got it very difficult to send any of their children, 30 miles down the road into the new Irish Free State or the Irish Republic. Such is what happens when the water of the gospel gets muddied with man's politics and stupidities. So right through the first virtually 70 years of the 20th century, evangelicals in the Republic of Ireland tended to keep their heads down. Now, some ventured forth with the gospel in different ways, but by and large it was a time of great quietness, of dwindling numbers in the churches, of an ageing church membership insofar as the churches still continue to exist. And thankfully there were those who, even in the face of that, prayed and prayed and prayed that God would move, that God would do something. Yes, Kenny?
Is Darby part of that time period?
J.N. Darby, he would have been a minister of the gospel back in, certainly it was about 1828 that he moved from Ireland to Plymouth, which gave rise to the nickname of the Plymouth Brethren. But he was a Dublin guy. And yes, there had been, but that was, again, that was back in that revival period. Yeah, that was back, he had left Ireland before the famine. He was, he had started the, if you like, non-clerical meetings before, back in the 1820s.
So he wasn't part of the Methodist?
No. Though there's no doubt that amongst those who became known then as the Brethren, that the influence of the gospel as preached by the Methodists and by others, kind of akin to the Methodists, that folks like the Brethren, there's no doubt that they were affected, but they became very involved with their own take on things, on their own vision of the church without the clergy, and so on. And as those who know me never cease to remind me, that maybe where I spent my first couple of years as a Christian, which is probably what has ruined me. But that was then, and then his influence really was in Britain after that. Yeah. Mm. But in the 20th century, then it was a time, certainly on the surface, of deadness here in the Republic. In the north of Ireland, we did have in the 30s and 40s quite a bit of what was regarded as revival, and it certainly was a tremendous time under the preaching of a man called W.P. Nicholson, who also preached quite a bit in the U.S., in the north of Ireland, where, you know, the folklore of it all, you know, and it's true too, but the stories of it all coming from that period in the 1930s and 40s was in the great shipyards of Belfast, you know, where they built the Titanic and so on, that they had to build these huge big sheds for the return of stolen property, you know, and that was a result of Nicholson's preaching then, and indeed that did contribute to the shaping of evangelicalism in the north of Ireland in that relatively more recent period of the mid 20th century. Here in the south, as I say, it was heads down and don't disturb anything, and which was understandable when so many of their co-religionists had been burned out in the 1920s and even in the 1930s. And of course, there was a lot of land wars and private scores being settled and the usual things that happened during a time of political and upheaval. But then came what to those of us who have lived through it became really the golden age. Now, of course, anybody who's seen anything of God moving always look on that period as the golden age. But to those of us who came to know Christ at the end of the 60s and during the 70s, this was Ireland's Jesus movement. This was quite amazing, when suddenly, instead of just churches keeping their heads down, all over the streets, people preaching the gospel, the hippie Christians, the all kinds of whatever names, the Jesus freaks, the all of that, which seemed to start spontaneously. I remember, because it was in that period, by 1970, that the God found me and dragged me up off the gutter. I forget where that sentence started, it doesn't matter. But I remember at that period, just the numbers who were coming to Christ, the numbers who were finding him, and all of them, without any Bible church connection or evangelical connection or anything like that, and in fact, who, you know, would be praying and wondering whether, as evangelicals had done during the 19th century, wondering whether Catholics could be saved, these guys were wondering whether it was possible for Protestants to get saved. That was what happened. It seemed to be spontaneous. And yes, I remember what I was going to say now. I remember sometime about 1971 or thereabouts, I'd been handed a copy of Time magazine, fresh in from the US. And the whole front cover was the Jesus generation. Half of that week's magazine was taken up with the story of what was going on, the Jesus freaks, all of that, the Jesus movement, with comments by all kinds of people. And essays in it by Billy Graham and this one and that one. And we were totally astonished to think that in America the same thing is happening as is happening in the streets in Dublin and Limerick and Cork and Galway here in Ireland. It was a time that for those of us who lived through it, it shaped our expectations of the church. It shaped our expectations of the gospel. It shaped our thinking of what is the gospel, and you know, and I suppose, dear help us, it made us difficult sometimes. It made us kind of difficult people sometimes to accommodate in proper churches. But there it is. That's the Jesus Movement, the very end of the 60s, but the 1970s in particular. New life bursting out. But I have to say that I am glad that amongst those amongst whom I came to Christ, I was introduced to, you asked me a little while ago about J.N. Darby, introduced me to the Dublin descendants of Darby, if you like, in the big gospel hall in Dublin. And I suppose that, like for quite a few of us, shaped our thinking of understanding scripture, of actually reading it ourselves, and that it's not really that difficult of a book. So it shaped that quite a bit in the little while I was there. And indeed, there are those who, when they hear me preach at times, inquire whether I'm Plymouth Brethren. Well, I'm probably not, and the Brethren would be the first to tell you that I'm not. They weren't even convinced when I was amongst them, but it certainly had an impact. But what I'm saying, the more important point I'm making, is that there were those who rejoiced, those whose churches had kept their heads down for 70 years past and more, were absolutely rejoicing and very accepting of, I tell you, a weird bunch of Christians. You know, who didn't fit in that well into traditional church life, and who didn't try very hard to either. But those older folks who made us welcome at times, now not all did, but those who did, actually impacted our lives quite a bit. But that move of God went on through the 70s. And then during that period, there was a parallel movement going on within the Catholic Church, known as the Charismatic Movement, where people began to meet for prayer and Bible study, and where indeed Bible Christians who were prepared to do so were welcomed with open arms to come in, because they knew their Bibles, and come in and preach. And unfortunately, many of us didn't take that opportunity. And some preferred to think of it, well, that's just Rome all over again, trying to get in on the act. That was a mistake. That was a huge, huge mistake, because there's no doubt that whatever about around the rest of the world, I can't answer for that, but that here in Ireland, the Charismatic Movement was a manifestation of hunger, people's hunger, wanting a Christ, wanting a gospel, wanting a book of life. But it was an absolutely wonderful time to be alive. We would get worried. We would get worried during the 70s, in a week when we didn't see several people coming to Christ. We'd get worried that we'd backslidden, or that we'd been deserted by God, or that we'd done something wrong. That was a good fear to have. Unfortunately, we've become accustomed to that idea now. And that's a pity. those movements for good or ill, and people will have different ideas about this, but both those movements, the charismatic movement I mentioned first, largely assimilated and subsumed into the Catholic Church, and has become just a kind of ginger group within the Catholic Church rather than what it potentially was. Now, many, many, many people who were first touched in that movement are standing for Christ in many places today throughout the country, leading churches and leading the Christian community in many ways throughout the country. But as a movement, it was subsumed into regular Catholicism. The Jesus movement, if you like, while it still continues to impact the lives of those of us who live through it, but largely that's been subsumed into, if you like, the regular older evangelical churches on the one hand, or into the new, sometimes empire-building, imported churches at the present time. Now, if that sounds bitter, I'm sorry, I don't mean it to be. It's a comment it's a comment of how I consider the impact and the impetus of both movements to have been at least stunted and dulled, but more particularly probably lost. As I said, I suggested about history at the outset, it's not a question of wanting to repeat, and even those of us who would love to see the 70s repeated again here in Ireland, you know, that's a false dream, a false hope, because even if it could happen, it wouldn't necessarily be to the good. It's what God's doing today that counts, not what God did. But it is good to remember, whether we're talking about St. Patrick or Colum Keel or Colum Bannis, or the Reformers, the best of them, I should say, or the Wesleyans, or the Derbyites, it's good for us to remember that God did open wells. That God did open wells. And that would be my encouragement to folks here in Ireland, is not to yearn for the good old days, but to remember the place in which we were digged. To remember as well the fountains of water that were opened. And yes, maybe as we read about the patriarchs, to dig out the wells again, that's not repetition. That's just recognizing the reality of the living water of God. And to go for that. History is only useful if it points us forward. And as I said at some stage, I think there, about I've lost it, haven't I? But as I said about history's purpose to point us forward. If we don't learn from that and to go forward into the new things of God, oh, they're only new to us, they're not new to God. God's been doing this for a long time. But they're new to us, and He brings us forward into a new thing, into a new experience of His reality. That's what we need to go for. That's what we need to experience. That's where we need to submit ourselves. To put aside those things that obviously history has proven to be of no avail, to be past, to be gone. But to hold on to that which is good, to hold on to that which is wholesome, to hold on to that which is health, which is gospel, which is shalom, which is God's life for us. That's the wholeness of the salvation. Let us run with patience, and that doesn't mean dead slow, but let us run with patience the race that's set before us. We have, whether we like it or not, been passed the baton by a lot of strange people. Well, thank God, it's been passed on to a lot of strange people too, hasn't it? So let's run with that. The kingdom of God on earth, that's all that's worth a going for. God bless you. Bye-bye.